Alaska was the third state to legalize marijuana when it passed a voter-initiated effort, Ballot Measure 2, in 2014. The state licensed commercial sales in October of 2016. Today, you see small business owners on many streets in Anchorage and certainly around the state plying their legal products to a potentially much larger audience. Because it was illegal before 2015, consumers may be shy about using it. They may feel undereducated and uninformed. So how do you learn what you need to know to be a careful consumer of marijuana or a best practices business operator? And even though it's now legal, are there still risks? We'll find out on today's program when we meet the professor, the business owner, and the regulator. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. So let's get started. I'm here in the studio with Reza Brown, an assistant professor in UAA's culinary program. Professor Brown graduated from UAA with an associate's in culinary arts and a bachelor's in journalism. She's owned a catering company, worked in restaurants, and written about food since 2009 for many publications, including the Anchorage Daily News. Now she teaches many restaurant skills in the culinary program. And today, August 29th, the first day of school at UAA, she launches that campus's first class in marijuana out of the culinary program. So Reza, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm surprised we could get you on the first day of school. But maybe everybody's registering and, you know, you've got a little window to run over here to the studio and talk to us.
Perfect timing.
Yeah. So we only have a little bit of time with you, but I wanted to tell people that I wanted to do this program when I saw that UAA had a class. I thought, oh, that is so cool. What a good way. And it also meant to me that this industry, marijuana and its legalization, it's now mainstreamed. People need information. How did you get the idea for a class?
So I teach hospitality concept design at UAA.
What does that mean?
So people come in with an idea for a restaurant or a cafe or a bakery, and then they have the semester to figure out a business plan, how to get investors, where the resources are. And in this class, I had a student approach me and ask about an on-site cafe consumption bakery that she wanted to do with edibles and cannabis. And as I'm helping her with this project, I realized that I didn't know where to direct her or where to help her find these resources. So over the past year, I've put together a team of retailers, dispensary owners, cultivators, and we have been kind of narrowing down this education into an 18-hour class, which is 6 3-hour classes, and then we can kind of cover all of those, the basics, the introductions of cannabis, and how to put it into edibles.
Mm. Was it a challenge to get the university to do this, or were they like also recognizing, hey, it's time, we need to step into this?
I think they recognized that there was a need, and that if anyone is teaching this, it should be the university, and they've been very supportive. And of course, you know, because it's not federally legal yet, we are not actually using cannabis on campus. We are using federally approved substitutions like hemp and CBD.
For the feel.
Yes, for the feel, and also because we want them to get their hands on the product and to work with it. And then in the future, when it does become federally legal, that may change. But for now, you have to be 21 to take the class, and we won't be using any of the cannabis in class.
Okay. And I guess, why do we need a class? In my own mind, I think I also feel like I don't know much and I don't really know where to go for it. And then I'm too shy to walk into a shop and say, I know nothing, you know?
Yeah.
So, so what are the things that we really need a class for?
So that's exactly like when you go into a shop, the people who are helping you may not necessarily know a lot either. They know what they know, right? But what we're trying to do is create a very comprehensive curriculum of decades of experience from people who have been growing and making these kinds of products for many years. And just instead of one person, relying on one person as a resource, we're trying to draw on industry expertise and experience so that we can provide students with as much information as possible.
Yeah, and accurate information and maybe, you know, validated information. Now, you have said to me that you are curating this class. You are not teaching this class. Tell me a little bit about that.
So I am a chef by trade and a writer. And as I was putting this class together, I realized that my background is not in cannabis. I'm not qualified to teach this class, but I am qualified to go out and find the teachers that can. So I've been, like I said, over the past year, approaching industry professionals and asking them if they wanted to be a part of this and teach, because they also recognize that there needs to be some kind of education for their consumers and for their employees. And currently, we also teach sanitation certification,
which would be in the kitchen, right?
Yes.
And if you're making edibles or if you're I don't know, dealing with a product that people are going to consume, sanitation is absolutely critical.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it just goes, it aligns already with what we're teaching. I also teach alcohol certification and a controlled substance. So it just makes sense that if we're teaching sanitation, alcohol certification, cannabis certification should be on that roster as well.
So, you know, right now, if you go into a store, a person selling you something over the counter has had some licensing from the state.
They have to pass the marijuana handler's card test. So okay. There is that.
Much like a bartender would have had to pass an alcohol handling. Okay.
Yes.
But I would like to talk a little bit about what you're going to cover in the class. I 6 weeks worth of, I mean, it's six sessions, I guess, yeah. 3 hours each. It's intense. So let's talk about some of the things you're going to cover.
Yeah, I would love to. One of the things that we'll be covering is terpenes, because what that has to do with culinary is they just go hand in hand.
That was a new word for me, terpenes. But it's like what makes food smell good.
Yep. And plants and, you know,
herbs, some, for example.
Right. Limonene, pinene, like these things are they're in present in plants and in our food. And when we talk about culinary and cannabis, that's the connection I see right away. And so this class is an introductory class. So we're just touching on these things. You could study terpenes for your whole life.
Right.
But we are trying to, you know, just kind of introduce people to the vocabulary and terminology and explain to them, because a lot of this is new language. So
yeah. Now terpene, you know, everybody thinks about THC, right? That's the big thing.
Yeah.
But terpenes are the flavor.
Yes.
And they interact with how do you say that?
Cannabinoids.
Yes, cannabinoids.
Yeah.
And the endocannabinoid system. How do they interact? And I don't mean to go way down the rabbit hole on that, but that's part of what you're going to be explaining.
Right. So we have receptors in the endocannabinoid system, and they do interact with terpenes and with the CBD, and it's like I said, you could study this for a long time.
Yeah.
And so in this class, and it is hard for us to just to cover the surface of this, but I hope in the future to offer more in-depth classes for subjects like terpenes or cultivation and partner with
gardening.
Other,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
And partner with other departments in the university so that they can offer their expertise in these subjects.
Right, right. So let's run quickly just a little bit about your day one, day two, day three. Just a quick overview of what people... And people can still sign up for this class.
They can. We are almost full, but we do have some spots available, and it doesn't start till September 13th. So,
and it's open to the community as well as to the campus. It's a one-credit class, I think.
It's a one-credit class, and you don't have to be a degree-seeking major. Anyone can take it. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, anyway, just, you know, I mean, the word dosing was one of the things that leaped out at me. It's like, I had the impression that marijuana has probably gotten stronger or the THC has gotten stronger. And then there's the difference between smoking or the different ways you can consume it plus eating it and the different ways your body reacts. So there's a lot about dosing. Not that you have to explain it all to us, but that's something you're going to cover.
And dosing is a little bit of a misnomer because it's like saying this is going to work for everybody. And that's absolutely not true. It's like alcohol. It's everyone's different. And when we talk about dosing in this class, we're going to talk about how to be conscious about the choices you make to take the least possible amount necessary and then work up from there. So for us, the dosing really is just a sitting down, asking yourself the questions of how do I ingest this? What are the reasons I ingest it? And figuring out the lowest possible dose to take for you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. And let's see, another area you're going to cover, plant anatomy, manufacturing overview, infusing recipes. Let's talk a little bit about that, because a lot of people are applying on their pets, on their own, you know, joints or things that need it, specially designed ointments and creams. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what that section is going to be like.
So on this team, I have a lot of really great people, and one of them is Chef Michelle Bombshell, and she's been working with edibles for years, and so has Judith Mack. She has been making creams and salves with CBD, and that's something that she'll be teaching. And then Donna Karaluk, the student that helped me start this class, the one who came to me with her concept, she is actually also helping teach this class.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, I love the full circle part of it. And she and Michelle and Judith will be doing a demonstration of infusions. And that's something that they'll do the three little workshops, and they'll just learn a very basic infusion recipe. Right.
So nobody is going to be coming to the class and be in the kitchen baking brownies or
no.
And when Judith or your other manufacturer person, will they be using hemp as they try
yes.
to make these things? So people can actually touch it and feel it, but it won't be marijuana or won't be what the extraction from marijuana.
That, right.
Okay. So no product comes out of this class. Nobody can say, oh, I'm going to get some brownies if I go to this class.
No product. They'll get some CBD salves, you know, to take home.
Those are not THC related,
no,
right?
No, not at all. And in fact, you can get CBD, you know, anywhere. You can get it at a coffee shop. So,
mm-hmm. yeah. Okay. So the other thing that struck me when I met you was that you weren't just trying to get this class. You didn't just envision the need for this class and then do the work to pull it together. You actually saw the need for much more, almost a cannabis college
right.
in a way. Could you talk a little bit more about your bigger idea?
Sure. So the Culinary Arts Program is the only accredited culinary arts program in Alaska, and we're accredited through the ACF, which is the American Culinary Federation. When I started researching this, I realized that they had a culinary cannabis certification at the national level. And I wanted to talk to them because they didn't recommend any curriculum or classes. They just had resources. So one of my ideas was to reach out to the ACF and say, hey, I'm offering this culinary cannabis class. Could we partner on this? And there is a need, I feel, and I've been doing research in Colorado and California about all the different classes that are offered.
And some of them are at universities, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are online. I think some of them are face-to-face. But for a hands-on thing like culinary cannabis or cultivation, you know, it's like I want to start making this curriculum where people can show up and touch the product and use the product and see what it's like. And we don't have that in Alaska. So I was mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. thinking that someone needs to provide it and the university should be the one to do it.
Yeah. I wonder if someday there'll be a PhD in cannabis.
Yeah. Doctor.
Doctor of cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you did tell me that when you began, as you said in the beginning, when your student said, I want to open a cannabis bakery, edible, you know, with edibles, you were like, oh my gosh, how do we start? Now you have spent almost a year mm-hmm. meeting people in the industry. And as you've said, you're curating this class, you're pulling from the community. Could you kind of give us a feel and your reaction to meeting all these people that are, you know, very knowledgeable, very invested, you know, professional in their approach mm-hmm. and what that's been like?
So I've had a really positive experience with the cannabis industry. I kind of got some recommendations from people in the community that were like, oh, this person will be great, and just very casual. And I would go to their business.
Just word of mouth.
Just word of mouth. I went to King Street Dispensary and I spoke to Nick, and he was very open to the idea. So he's been helping me out with the cultivation part of it, and he's teaching the cultivation.
They'll actually be in front of students.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, and we're hoping to get some field trips planned as well so that they can see what a grow operation looks like, visit a dispensary, and if they want to open a retail, kind of have also the professionals as resources to ask directly these questions, right? Because it's, again, where do you find this mm-hmm. information? And then I have Bailey from Green Jar out in the valley, and then Aaron Ralph from Ace Dispensary. Mm. So it's kind of, you know,
it's a whole team.
Yeah, it's a whole team. And they're all really knowledgeable. They've been doing this for a long time. They're helping, you know, they attend all of the meetings. And so they have a lot of information to provide. And I'm excited to have them.
That's really great. I almost feel like I want to talk to you after the class and sort of say, okay, what do you think? Well, how did it go? Yeah. You know, and even interview some of the students. Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, that would be. So you say you can take what? You said 25 or you're almost full.
Yeah. So right now we're at 18. So I think, yeah, we have 7 more spots available and they're filling up quickly too. So.
Yeah. And if people, you know, say you're not a university student and you then over to UA to see movies or theater or something, how do you go about getting into this class?
So you would just contact our student success advisor, Whitney Flores, and you can find her online.
This is in the culinary college?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if they call the culinary school, that's where they could get started.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I just want to ask you, you know, just for a closing, what do you want people to think about? You know, we just had this conversation about the class. What do you want to leave people with?
I just want them to know that I'm not a proponent any one way or another of how you take this product, or even if you don't take this product, that part doesn't matter to me. What's important to me is that you have the resources and the education available to you if you want it.
Okay. So it's all about the information. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not about advocating or discouraging people. It's like, be informed.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, Reza Brown. She's a professor in the culinary program at UAA, teaching the very first cannabis class on the UAA campus. And next, we're going to leave the studio. So follow me, find out where we're going to go. Stay with us. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm producer Ammon Swenson. In this next segment, host Kathleen McCoy and I abandon the studio for an on-site visit to Secret Garden, a marijuana shop on busy 15th Avenue near downtown. This shop in the old Dooley's Costume Store maintains a menu of products from around Alaska, as well as growing its own flower and manufacturing in-house concentrates and edibles. So let's step inside and meet owner James Thornton.
Like I said, this is our brand new room.
Okay. Oh my gosh, it's warm in here and it smells earthy in here. I mean, you can smell green. You can smell green. These plants, it's a room full of plants. I guess this is probably, 1,300 square feet? And we've got rows and rows and rows of plants. They're really at my head height or above. And they're all organized. It's like they're a little army of plants in here. So, I don't know, what's that smell? What are we smelling, James?
Well, we're smelling terpenes. And those are naturally occurring molecules that are the taste and the smell of cannabis and a lot of other plants and even animals.
Also, there's like a fan every 2 feet in this room, and you can hear them. Why is that so important? Is it that you're trying to dry out the foliage, or what are you trying to do?
So airflow is really important with growing cannabis, and we want as a homogeneous blend of air as we can. So you cannot have too many fans in a grow room. And this is one of our newest grow rooms, and I wanted to put that theory to a test. So I literally could not put in another oscillating fan in this room. And because of the fact that we are injecting CO2 into the room, which the plants breathe through their stomatas, and that is essential for photosynthesis, which of course allows the plant to mature to its fullest potential, we want that CO2 to be everywhere. And in order to do that properly, you need good airflow in the room, in addition to other things.
So the lights are bright in here, the walls are white, you're going for as much reflection as you can. Are the lights on 24/7?
No. So cannabis, like many other plants, is triggered into the flowering stage by the lights changing to a 12 and 12 cycle, which is 12 hours of light, 12 hours of dark, through the vegetative cycle before they start their reproductive growth. You can have anywhere between 18 to 24 hours of light, which keeps the plant growing in a vegetative state, getting bigger and not reproducing or producing trichomes and flower. And you can do a lot of different things. There's a lot of different ways to trigger a plant. There's a lot of ways to find efficient ways to use light, 14 and 10, some other things. But generally, in a large commercial scale cultivation, we like to keep things as simple as possible here and to streamline it, lower our labor needs. And of course, again, like you said, in this room, 12 hours of light, 12 hours of darkness. You want to make sure that darkness is completely dark. Otherwise, the plants will be some of them will be shocked into thinking that they need to reproduce. Although, of course, you know, everyone knows that back in the day, there was always the ditchweed that next to the highways. So some strains can handle it, some strains can't. And it's all about growing. We have lots of challenges with every cycle.
You know, you mentioned, is it trichomes? So, I mean, we're right next to a plant right here. It doesn't have trichomes on it yet.
It absolutely does, actually. And I was looking to see if I had a scope, because one of the jobs of a cultivator is to watch these oil glands known as trichomes and their maturation process. So when a cannabis plant starts growing, when it's just a vegetative state, you can see some varieties with trichomes, which is a good sign that they're going to be a good producer and have lots of terpenes and cannabinoids. However, when you start flowering, that's really when the oil glands start to reproduce, and you start to see bud formation. And then what we do is we use jeweler's loops or scopes and look at the trichomes, which are that's what contains the cannabinoids and the terpenes. So we're very careful with those, watching them and seeing when they become mature, which is those trichomes will go from translucent, totally see-through, when they're just in the growing stage, which are very beautiful to watch. And then you'll start to see them go opaque. You'll start to see different varieties have different colors of basically amber or different content shooting up into that oil gland, which is a teardrop shaped, and then eventually becoming opaque and amber, sometimes purple, sometimes red. We've seen all sorts of varieties. And as that plant becomes mature and it gets into its harvest window, when it's ready to be harvested, we start to see those trichomes meet their full potential. But it's up to us to listen to the plant and see. Plants don't lie. Plants always tell the truth, which is why I love working with plants so much. And those oil glands, as they mature, will give us the desired effects that we're looking for, depending on when we cut them and how they mature. And of course, it's conditional on how you grow them as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is one grow room, James, but yeah. You've got how many?
Well, we have 7 flower rooms in the building and 3 vegetative rooms, and with an additional one coming online. We're really blessed to have an amazing facility, 25,000 square feet, which we're, of course, bolstering 3 licenses: retail, cultivation, and manufacturing. And of course, the manufacturing in our case includes a commercial kitchen and extraction laboratory. So we're just really blessed to be able to do this seed to sale. And that's always been my dream, which is to be able to control the process and also be able to do business with some other amazing cultivators and manufacturers, in some case retailers, to be able to continue to support the health of our industry.
So we've just walked into what's called the extraction room, and you can hear the metal sounds, the sounds of machines at work, and we're going to talk about it, and James is going to sort of tell us what's actually going on in these machines. It's a big part of your business.
Absolutely, it sure is. We're blessed to be able to do it.
So tell me what is exactly happening. What are these machines loaded with?
So at the beginning of the extraction process, we use cannabis biomass, which can be anything from trim to flower. And we go through a process where, in our case with carbon dioxide extraction, we first pull the terpenes out, which are naturally occurring substances that are volatile. So when heat is applied, they dissipate and they disappear.
They're fragile. You have to take really good care of them or you'd lose them.
Yes. So because we are pulling oil out of biomass, which is the carbon that is necessary for plants to grow, for that oil to be produced, we need to expose it to CO2 that's pressurized and chilled, which can make those terpenes go away. So we pull the terpenes first with specific set points so that we can preserve them. Then we take that biomass and we activate the THC. And when we activate the THC, it's exposed to heat, which again makes the terpenes dissipate. And when we pull the oil out, it is activated, so it can be used for any number of things, including edibles and concentrates. And concentrates with CO2 generally are oil, which can either be further refined by other companies or ourselves to go into cartridges, vaporization cartridges, or we can also put it into a syringe and that oil can also be utilized as a concentrate.
So did you have to get a special license to do the extraction?
Absolutely. We operate in the municipality of Anchorage, which requires a special land use permit for our use, which is manufacturing. And it was a long process. It actually required us to go through some extra steps through the municipality to allow for extraction in our zoning area. And we were able to basically vet that CO2 and other types of extraction methods like rosin press or other types of glycerin transfers for tinctures, those kinds of extraction methods are safe and shouldn't be considered dangerous when you have residentials in the area. We were able to change our local Title 21 and allow for this use in our area as long as we weren't using more dangerous explosive solvents such as butane.
So I understand correctly, the extraction of oil is really a signature part of your business. I mean, we might not find this at another vertically integrated manufacturing site. I mean, it's a big part of yours. Do you take material from other growers and extract the oil for them here as a service that you do for other growers and then return the oil to them? Or how does that work?
Well, there is a lot of product on the market right now due to the glut or a lot of licensees. And we do offer to certain cultivators the ability for them to transfer us their trim, which is a lower quality cannabis flower, or in some cases flower itself. And what we'll usually do is we'll apply a credit on our wholesale account so that they can then take advantage of the array of products that we produce here, rather than just getting back, let's say, one type of product from what they give us. So, but there's a whole lot of different things that we do with the flower, with the trim here, and with the oil, including wholesaling the oil to other manufacturers, because we have a machine that's capable of producing what they need easier. We also do some refinement, but it's a basic refinement, and because of our extractor, the quality is very high coming right out of it.
So anyway, we've had this amazing tour and met a lot of your team members and saw a lot of your process. I want to know, how long have you been doing this? How long have you been open? And you know, when you come into a community, I'd like to know how you get the community to know you and to know the community. How did you go about doing that?
Thanks, Kathleen. Well, everyone's different in the way that they start these businesses and run them, depending on what communities they're in and their processes. Obviously, there's a state process, but in Anchorage, we have a public process as well that includes sending out letters to your neighborhood within 500 feet. And I followed up as well and knocked on the doors. My dad and I decided that we would go through the full public process before we started building, due to a lot of things, just being smart, fiscally concerned with a large venture like this and wanting to make sure that it was the right location. And me personally, I've always just wanted to know my neighbors and make sure that everyone was cool with, you know, with me, or in this case, what the use of the land would be. So through the public process, you have to have a meeting, and I chose to have my meeting at the community council, where I met some great folks that have been here for decades and are always fighting for Fairview, an area that really is ready. It's time. Fairview's, you know, ready for change. So we started retail, had its first day of operation August 22nd, 2001. Excuse me, 2019. So we just celebrated 3 full years of operation, 7-day operation, 16 hours a day, minus 1 day for a COVID cleaning during the pandemic. So over 1,000 days in operation. The cultivation started in that June of 19, and the manufacturing was licensed just after the retail. So we're really blessed. I feel like the community is better because of it. Everyone really does their part. We're really involved with the Fairview Elementary School. And of course, you know, being cautious, because we know that not everyone is about cannabis. So I usually don't, you know, throw out that, you know, I'm about the cannabis. I'm usually just involved with the community and being proactive, being involved with the Federation of Community Councils as our delegate for the neighborhood, and also involved with the homelessness situation and an ad hoc committee that we have, as well as the Fairview Business Association, so that we can affect positive change in the neighborhood. Because if we don't, then, you know, if we don't continue to fight for what's right here in Fairview on so many levels, then nothing's going to change. So I feel like this use and some of the other great business owners, including some cannabis licensees here in Fairview, are really affecting positive change and showing that not only are we just a normal business like everyone else, but we actually contribute quite a bit, not only to the local sales tax kitty, but the state excise as well. And I think we're making some waves. And so I'm excited to see things continue to evolve in a way that positively affects our industry as well as Anchorage and Alaska as a whole.
James, thanks so much for giving us your time today and this mini tour of Secret Garden. Right after a short music break, we're going to meet the regulator, the director of the Alaska Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, charged with keeping this industry safe for consumers. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. And in this section, we're going to meet Joan Wilson, who is, I've been calling her the regulator. She's the director of the Office of Alcohol and Marijuana Control. So I call her the regulator, but there's a whole board involved. There's a staff involved. But I think of Joan as
a different perspective we have. We've had the professor, we've had the entrepreneur, now we have the regulator. So Joan Wilson, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be on a show I've listened to for years.
Okay. Well, I just in case people don't know you, I know a lot of people do know you, but I'm going to say you've been in the legal field for 25 years. You've done civil and criminal law, public and private. And I was amazed to find out that you had been advising the AMCO office, Alcohol Marijuana Control Office, as an attorney in the Attorney General's office, an assistant attorney general, and that you actually kind of wrote the book on cannabis law. I guess it is for all the states. Well, not all the states. It's called the Attorney General Alliance's book on cannabis.
The Attorney General Alliance's cannabis law desk book. And basically all the AGs who had been advising regulators took the subject of cannabis law and divided it between us. I wrote the chapter on cannabis products.
Okay.
Others wrote about taxation and licensing schemes.
All those really scintillating topics, right? But that's where the money is, right? So taxing is important.
Right.
So, when we met beforehand, I point blank asked you, are you a consumer of marijuana? Because I was curious, would that be why you learn all about it and everything? And I came to find out that no, I am not. Yeah.
I am a curious person. That's what I would say I was. Or still am.
Yeah.
I had been a healthcare attorney for really the majority of my career and had been advising healthcare boards, dental boards, medical boards at the Attorney General's office, mm-hmm. excuse me. And one day I came into work and they said, Joan, we need you to do this. And I'm a team player. I jumped in.
You're going to write the book on cannabis.
Well, what happened is the synapses in my brain just exploded because when you do something 25 years, you know it pretty well.
Yeah.
I had to learn an industry. I had to go to a board meeting and not even know what the statute and the regulations say.
Yeah.
And I'm someone who doesn't like to disappoint. But in learning, I just became really, really interested, specifically in how a new industry just comes to life.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to say,
Alaska.
Why did you want the job? Well, you kind of answered that. It was just, there's a lot there to learn. I was thinking, well, maybe it's the highest paid position. That's why she wanted it. No, because everybody's mad at you all the time, right? I mean, it's a bit of a hot seat, right?
It's a little bit of that, but I try to remember what my mother taught me, which is be polite to people and listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first job I had where I really feel like I get to be my mother's daughter.
Mm.
You know, I got to be a lawyer and mean for to a lot of people.
Mean?
Mean zealously in representing my case.
Yes.
Mean's the wrong word, but
right.
I could be quite
tough.
Argumentative.
Tough. Yeah.
Yeah. And on behalf of my clients, including this client when it was mine. But now I get to listen and use that part of we can make government better. I've had 57 years of government experience as someone who's, just on the end user side, and I know what bad government service is, and I know what good government service is.
Yeah.
We can provide good government service.
Yeah. So that's your motivation for taking the job.
Most definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. And I want to say, you haven't been there forever, just in May, the Governor Dunleavy appointed you as the director. And I guess I just want to know, do you lay awake at night? What's your toughest?
Sure.
What are the things that make you like, oh, gosh, I hope we get that right. What do you worry about?
Got it. First, can I say thank you to Governor Dunleavy for taking a chance on someone he never knew? But I will
somebody
say
somebody must have said something nice about
the
you.
Board and the industry. You heard from a lot of people. So I really appreciate this opportunity. What keeps me up at night? Different perspectives. Again, I believe the government needs to serve the people. And here in the state of Alaska, about 440 licensees pay my office $1.7 million a year in program receipts. They expect a working government, and they deserve
They're
that.
Paying for it, right?
Yeah.
They pay
my office, as do the alcohol licensees. So I care about our process. I care about it being timely. I care about getting the information to the boards that they need to decide on whether a license should be granted or renewed. So that part is a very important part of the job. That said, I'm the mom of a 14-year-old that I love beyond measure. And one of the major requirements of a state that is legalizing cannabis is to ensure against diversion to minors. So I have no problem with kids being educated so that when they're 21, they can with the background of sound education, try this product, but I don't want anyone younger than 21 utilizing it.
Right. And even, you know, I heard a statistic on a news story that one in five youth under 21 in Alaska have had some exposure, maybe have tried a product. You know, it gets there anyway. And it's like, so does alcohol.
Yeah.
So
I'm the mom of a 14-year-old. I'm certain. Yeah. I see where the kids go and we're not here. They're with them all the time. And they're going to be curious.
So, And, you know, to that end, because that sort of public safety, because I read your mission is to sort of watch the licensing and make sure the standards are good in the interest of public safety.
Right.
So that's a big part of your role. Of course, I want to go to the money, not because I want to leave the safety issue, but because some of the money is going toward that safety issue.
Right.
So let's talk about what the industry has done for the state. They've funded your office, but they're also contributing to the general fund. Let's talk a little bit about what this industry has brought to the state financially.
So in the year that we just finished, fiscal year 2022, the state brought approximately $28.9 million into the general fund through excise taxes alone. That's about $2.3 million.
Is this just marijuana? Or is this
just marijuana?
So say those numbers again.
$28.89 million a year past fiscal year, which ended June 30th.
So that's on the taxing of the selling of marijuana.
Correct.
Okay. And tell us a little bit, just for people who don't know that aren't maybe in the industry, how does it get taxed? You know, what is the process?
So I think this is one of the last kind of political hot buttons for the legislation. And the determination was to tax on the per ounce level of marijuana. So originally it was $50 per ounce. Back in 2019, they graduated the tax to create a $25 an ounce for buds or flowers that didn't mature. So you had
a little less
tax on
less valuable part of the plant. And then finally, I think I read $15 for trim, something like that, that was in there. That's okay. Don't worry about that.
I'll look at my notes. Yeah.
So,
and I can't say revenue handles the tax end. So they,
right.
they can
it's
look
not
at
even
that
in your, I asked you that question and I know that's not your department.
That said, it's really important to the licensees because they have a tax right now that is stagnant, even as the market price drops. So they're paying the same amount of tax for if it was $1,000 a pound as if it were $200 a pound.
Right, right, right. And I talked to an entrepreneur who said, well, I think they should tax by THC, which is the psychotropic volume,
psychoactive
ingredient. And I don't even know how you would do that. But he said that you know, by weight is just killing us. And I think, you know, part of that is so many flooding the field that they're not able to go to market like they would. And they're paying the same amount if they sell, as you said, 100 pounds or if they sell 1,000 pounds, they're still paying $50 an ounce. So are you optimistic that there might be some change there?
I'm optimistic because I think there are smart people that care about it and they'll work with the governor's office and the legislature. I can tell you some of the newer states that have legalized cannabis, such as New York and Illinois, went to the potency level.
Oh, they did.
Testing.
So some are there.
Yeah. And we based a lot of our regulations and statute by the states that came before us. So Colorado and Washington formed a lot of our experience, but now we have our own experience and we know what works in Alaska and what doesn't.
Yeah. You invited me to tune into a listening session you had in August with, I guess it was just entrepreneurs in general. It was growers.
All licensees.
All licensees. Okay. And they had a lot of ideas for you on how they would like to see things. One of the things they talked about was, it takes so long to get something through the office. And one of the questions they pose is, do you have enough staff? And what do you think about that? Can you think of ways things can move faster?
All right. Well, let me start with this. When you have a budget of approximately $4 million, I won't sit in this chair and say that's not enough money. We will make that money work, especially when it's paid for by licensees. So, do we have enough staff? Yes, we have enough staff. We have a bit of turnover that I have to fix by helping people realize what a wonderful office AMCO is. By the way, I'll have three positions that you might be able to find on Workplace. I might as well say it here. And
if you're looking for a job.
You're looking for a job. Come see me because I care about you and your future. But one of the easiest part of taking this job was the incredible team of people that I have. Mm-hmm. We have working. I don't like using the word I. Mm-hmm. We have working for us. And you know, people say a lot of things about state employees. Well, these state employees come in on Saturday. These mm-hmm. state employees work nights. Yeah. If, for example, we're in the middle of the marijuana renewal season, if we didn't get renewal licenses out by August 15th, which we did, by the way, these licensees would have their bank accounts shut down. Uh-huh. I mean, and think about an industry that is lucky to get bank accounts because yeah. of their federal status.
Right.
We don't want to be that problem and for
by
them.
That, it's basically the federal government is not allowed marijuana proceeds to move through banks.
Yeah, yeah. That, I mean, there's
like
some
that.
State banks. There's a whole chapter about that in that cannabis law.
Write, yeah.
No, I didn't write that
oh,
chapter,
write them,
but
yeah.
I can tell you it's becoming less complicated to get banks, but they're primarily out of state banks. The Alaska banks are still conservative when it comes to allowing marijuana licensees to bank there, which is another, you said another thing that keeps me up at night, thinking about these businesses being cash-based and the potential harm to licensees and their employees.
Yeah, the danger that somebody might come in to
yeah.
get the money.
Right.
So what do they do here in the state? Do they drive late at night into some place and deposit their money? What do they do?
Oh, I'm not the best person okay. to answer that, but I'm certain they go from ATM to ATM and, you know, there's a maximum or minimum amount you can put into each one. Mm-hmm. I'm certain they might have their own ATMs and are able to use those to and wire
they,
money.
And they make deposits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's so interesting. Let's see. We're getting sort
okay.
of down to the wire here. Let me think what we talked about the risks. We talked about what keeps you awake at night. We talked about the amount of money coming into the mm-hmm. state, which is pretty amazing. I guess are you able to say, is the industry thriving?
I believe the industry is thriving.
And, yeah. and even though it's tough, I mean, I heard licensees saying maybe we should limit licenses, you know, and then the philosophy
yeah.
was let the marketplace decide. But we'll see. I mean, it sounds like if you're having listening sessions, anything is up
yeah.
for discussion.
So the industry thrives in a couple of ways. One, any industry that's bringing $30 million into the state, you know, that's the portion they pay the state. And I get it. That's a large amount of money. But hopefully they have some profit margin on top of their own operations. They're employing people. Mm-hmm. You know, they're successful throughout the state. Yes, originally when the ballot measure became the legislation and then the regulations, the thought is let the market decide. We're not going to limit or cap licenses. That's a decision for the board to reach in the future. I will follow
yeah.
board directive
sure,
on
sure.
that. I do think that most of the licensees that are doing the best right now are those that integrate, that are cultivators, that are product manufacturers,
yeah.
that have their own store. But that doesn't mean I don't care about the limited cultivator that, right. you know, has a small grow and knows the plant and wants
loves
to do
this
well.
Product and wants to
right.
share it. Yeah. Well, we are sort of out of time, but
okay.
I just wanted to share with our listeners this little detail about Joan that I thought people would find interesting. She did write the book on cannabis or a chapter in the book on cannabis, but also she is the author of a book that you should know about, The Book of Timothy, The Devil, The Brother, and Me by Red Hand Press, which is a sad story about your brother being molested by a Catholic priest in your parish, and then you're following that to get some justice out of
to
that.
To Rome
yeah.
to
yes. Yes.
attempt to get a confession. It's a good story. I recommend
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So, you know, you're not a one-dimensional regulator.
I am not.
Yeah.
And the most important thing I am is a mom.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And an Alaskan, I say that too. I love this state. And just to be part of this industry from a regulator's end mm-hmm. and part of making people's lives better. You know, one thing we didn't talk about is there is a way this product is helping people. I met at least three licensees who are no longer addicted to opioid, who have, lifelong injuries that this product is helping. And if it's helping them, it's helping other Alaskans.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole medicinal, that's another whole topic,
right.
But, right? But that's an interesting example. So anyway, we are out of time. And I just have to say thank you, Joan Wilson, the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office for the state of Alaska. Thank you so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And now something new for Hometown Alaska. After a short break, we'll hear State of Art.
Welcome to State of Art on Hometown Alaska, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, I sit down with the managing editor of the Anchorage Press, O'Hara Scheip. She took over the job back in March after a long time contributing stories and photos to the paper. Outside of the press, she's the director of cannabis magazine Alaska Leaf and has her own photography business. The homegrown journalist was born in Anchorage but left for prep school in Massachusetts at 13.
Stayed out on the East Coast in New England through college at Brown and then had a pretty cool pro hockey career all over Europe and was in Ireland and Sweden, Russia, and then Canada. My career ended in 2013 when I messed up my hip and oddly got viral meningitis in Russia. So it was a pretty hard landing. I came back up to Alaska in 2013. And so now here we are about a decade later.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your hockey career. How long were you doing that? And I mean, obviously you were taking it pretty serious.
Yeah. So I started when I was five, ironically, because my next door neighbor said I couldn't play hockey because I was a girl. And then furthermore, I couldn't be a goalie because I couldn't do the splits. So me being the kind of intrepid kid that I was, I walked straight up to my parents and let them know I was going to go play ice hockey. And so here we are, you know, 31 years later, I'm playing beer league hockey now with the guys and I'm retired, but got to play Division One, won a few national titles, some European championships. So kind of went all over the place with it. I was lucky.
Totally. And I mean, obviously, you think you'll still kind of keep up with it, kind of some of the like beer league type stuff as you get older?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, the joke is kind of like if you do hockey right as a pro, like you all end up in the same place, which is beer league. So we're all a bunch of beer league all-stars out there twice a week. And my body's pretty wrecked, but, you know, it's the one fun time I get to spend with just the guys and kind of just get to let loose and not be O'Hara Scheip for a day. I kind of just get to be the goalie.
Yeah, totally. Probably get to vent some of that aggression out too a little bit.
It's nice to trash talk a little bit because, you know, when you're working in any professional job, you have to have that customer service slant to you. And you definitely do not have that for hockey.
Totally. When did you take over as the managing editor of the press?
Yep. So March 15th was my official first day. So we're coming up here on 9 months.
How's it been so far? I know you've been super busy.
Yeah, I think there's a misconception with the press that we're a really big operation. I think a lot of people have always thought of the press as having a big team, but it's always been a bootstrap kind of operation. And currently I'm the only one on the editorial staff. So it's super busy. You know, I'm doing everything from layout to copy editing to writing multiple bylines, photographing, you know, you're running the website, the social media. So, you know, when you see the press, it's, you know, it's hard for people to fathom that that's all coming from one person, but it really is.
Yeah. And I mean, outside of the press, you've also mentioned that, you know, there's some other publications that you have your hands on as well.
Yeah. So I'm also the state director for a cannabis magazine called Alaska Leaf, and I've been with them for about 2 years. And it's been a really interesting juncture in my career as a journalist because it was something I'd never covered. And through it, I've met some really, really interesting people. And there's all these really cool things happening with the cannabis industry here in Alaska. So I've kind of tipped my toes into a whole new industry, which has been awesome.
Yeah. You know, I mean, coming from kind of your super serious like hockey background, what got you interested in journalism in the first place?
You know, it was really kind of a fluke. I was working at the University of Alaska Anchorage and was working in fine and performing arts. And I knew that we had a student who was doing graphic design work for the press. And I kind of just put my name in the hat to maybe try writing. Mike Dunham at the ADN had been someone I'd been sending press releases to and had kind of encouraged me to try. So when I approached the press originally, it was just to be a photographer for like the late night Wednesday gigs for press picks. And there was really no intention of ever being a journalist. But when my first editor, I met her and she had asked me if I could write and I let her know I went to Brown. So I'd hope so. Otherwise, we probably just paid a house cost for my education and I can't write. You know, and then that was, you know, 6 years ago. So I just kind of fell into it, to be honest.
What are some of your favorite, either maybe favorite pieces that you've had in the press so far, or maybe just generally favorite things to cover?
Yeah, I think one of my favorite stories is the second one I ever wrote for the press. It was about a band called Buck Cherry out of California. It's funny because everyone thinks I'm this like huge extrovert, but I'm actually very much a forced extrovert. I really like to be introverted and giving cold calls. I'd sweat profusely and stumble over my words and it really stressed me out. So when I knew Buck Cherry was coming into town, I really wanted to interview them. So I ended up calling randomly their management in LA and kept getting passed up this phone tree just endlessly. It was a panic attack after panic attack, basically, until I got through to someone who scheduled an interview. And to date, it's actually one of the few major bands that I've interviewed in person. So I was in their dressing room before the concert and talking to them. And there's just this really cool connection. I think I caught the singer on a day where he just wanted to be really candid. And I had an opportunity to really tell a fully fledged story. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. And I mean, you've kind of continued your interest in covering bands and kind of arts, cultural stuff in Anchorage too, right?
Yeah. So I love to cover arts and culture and music because I think there's a little bit of a gap. ADN, it does such a great job with politics and opinion pieces, and I don't have staff to try to keep up with that. But I, you know, saw a hole for getting music and bands more coverage. And I'm like, well, I could fill that hole. Music's always been my passion. I'm basically that journalist kid from Almost Famous. You know, I have such a reverence for music and musicians, and it's how I've expressed myself, was just making mixtapes. I still do on Spotify.
Well, let's talk about your photography a little bit, because I think when I first heard about you, it was probably through your photos before I had started to see your writing. And I know you do a lot of it outside of even just your journalism stuff as well.
I do. Yeah. So I've got my first camera in prep school when I was 13 as a freshman. It was this like plastic Holga camera that you had to tape together so the light wouldn't seep in. And the camera very quickly became the way for this, you know, introverted person to start experiencing the world around them and to have an excuse to engage with people. But then I chose hockey over basically everything else. So when I finally retired in 2013, I knew that photography was something I wanted to fall back on. And I actually ended up approaching a commercial photographer named Chris Arend up here and asked him if I could clean his studio and carry his bags in exchange for like lessons on being a commercial photographer. And I just, you know, I fell in love with it. It took, I would say, years for me to finally be comfortable photographing people up close. I was definitely out there with a sniper lens trying to photograph people from super far away because I was so embarrassed to engage. And then when my telephoto lens broke, I didn't have a choice. I was like, well, I have a 50 millimeter, so I guess we're talking to people.
Getting nice and close.
Very close. I'm like, well, I'm going to be in your face and photographing your pores. I hope that's okay.
Yeah. So I guess maybe, you know, let's talk about the kind of introvertedness, but kind of forced extrovert thing.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm the same way, but for some reason I have a job in radio, you know, like we kind of, what do you think it is that, you know, we're introverted, but we're kind of continuously putting ourselves out there? Why is that, you think?
Well, I think of you as an artist, obviously, and being part of the music scene, and I'm an artist with photography. I draw, I write poetry, and I think that you can't really express and be an artist without being engaged in the world. And so I think a lot of us who are introverted naturally try to force ourselves into more extroverted positions, because where else are you going to get the art inspiration? Where are you going to be able to create your art even? So for me, photography has been this way to deal with trauma, to deal with insecurities, and I couldn't do that by myself. I mean, I could, but I don't really like being photographed ever. So unless it's a good selfie. So I think that's why. I think a lot of us artists, you know, we need that expression. We need to be able to be around people in order to really create.
Totally. You know, you've got a pretty good street level view of some of the things going on in Anchorage. You know, just you're always out there. You always have something going on. What are some positive things happening in this town that people can be excited about, you think?
This one, am I?
take your time.
Yeah, I'm like, ooh. No, I think, you know, one of the positives actually has been for me this summer. I discovered rugby at the tender age of 36 with a lot of injuries from pro hockey. I thought, let's go play rugby. That sounds like a great idea. And what I've tapped into is this whole community of people, a particularly Polynesian community, who's never heard of O'Hara Shipe, who's never heard of the Anchorage Press. And so I got to go into this environment being completely anonymous. So I'm actually shippy on the rugby pitch, or oh gosh, she's scary. That's, or at least that's in my head what I am. And it's really opened up my eyes to a community that I would have never otherwise met. And I think even just now living out in Muldoon and seeing how much culture and cool stuff there is in the neighborhood, I grew up on the Upper Hillside and, you know, was maybe a little bit bougie growing up, and moving completely across town, it's really changed my perspective on Alaska and the people here, the culture. It's so much more diverse than I would have ever known. So I think like the summer in particular has been eye-opening for that. And I'm trying to translate it into the press by having more BIPOC writers, by reaching out to small businesses that would normally never get featured in the paper, and trying to kind of suss out those stories and can paint, you know, a more interesting, vibrant picture of our city.
Yeah, totally.
Look at that spin.
I love it. So, I mean, sometimes I feel like personally I can take the press for granted because you walk around town, you see it everywhere. You know, it's just always kind of there. But, you know, even without me taking it for granted, I'm sure there's a lot of people that do, you know, still rely on the information and stuff that gets provided there. So I guess kind of broad strokes, what do you think is the importance of maintaining like a local Alt Weekly?
Yeah, well, I think Alt Weeklies fill a really interesting niche in the community because they cover things that traditional media wouldn't. So a perfect example being the Black Lives Matter movement. The Anchorage Press was one of the only outlets that actually covered the person who started the march, the original march. And it was this really wonderful transgendered boy named Marcus Vinson. And he had such an amazing story, and I couldn't imagine anybody else starting a Black Lives Matter movement here other than Marcus. And his story was probably a little too much for normal media to really cover. But as an Alt Weekly, we have so much more freedom to really tell stories the way they are and the unabridged version, because there's, you know, so much fluctuation on what you can actually put in an Alt Weekly. And I feel like in Anchorage, it's so important because there's so many voices that are marginalized that don't get coverage. And I've personally made it my mission as the press to cover those stories, to give voices to the voiceless, and to use the Alt Weekly as a platform for change, even just covering what's happening in Centennial Park or the abortion rally. You know, we're able to take such a different view than any other outlet in the state. And I feel like if an Alt Weekly were ever to go away, that's what the state would be missing. We'd be missing those stories and those voices you're not going to hear anywhere else.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe one more final thing is just kind of, you know, obviously those diverse voices are super important to, you know, telling diverse stories. So if people do want to contribute, because it is a community paper, how do people get in touch with you if they want to write for the press?
Yeah. So if you're a writer who is really interested in covering different segments of the population, I'm really interested in getting more stories from BIPOC, from Polynesian, from Hispanic culture, then, you know, shoot me an email at editor@anchoragepress.com. I'd love to talk to you. I really want to continue to develop those things. So if you're a music writer too, and you're interested in heavy metal and hip hop, we're looking for someone. So definitely shoot me an email.
That was my conversation with managing editor of the Anchorage Press, O'Hara Scheib. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
I'd like to thank our guests today for giving us an update on the legal marijuana industry in Alaska. If you missed any part of this show, please find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Ammon Swenson is our producer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.